Sally brought the iced tea and poured more lemonade. When she was gone, Jake said, "On the wagon?"
"No, never. Just taking a break. I'd like to live for 20 more years, Jake, and I worry about my liver. I don't want to die, and I don't want to give up Jack Daniels, so I'm in a constant quandary. I worry about this all the time, and the worry and stress and pressure eventually become too much and can only be alleviated by the Jack."
"Sorry I asked."
"Are you drinking?"
"Not really. An occasional beer, but we don't keep it around the house. Carla frowns on it, you know."
"My second wife frowned on it, too, and she didn't last a year. But then, she didn't look like Carla."
"Thanks, I guess."
"Don't mention it. Sally's cooking vegetables, if that's okay."
"Delicious." There was an unwritten checklist of topics they always covered, and usually in an order that was so predictable, Jake often suspected that Lucian had notes tucked away somewhere. The family, Carla and Hannah, the office and the current secretary and any profitable cases that had popped up since the last visit, the lawsuit against the insurance company, the investigation into the Klan, the latest on Max Stafford, the attorney who had disappeared and taken his client's money, gossip about other lawyers and judges, college football, and, of course, the weather. They moved to a small table at the other end of the porch where Sally was arranging lunch, butter beans, squash, stewed tomatoes, and cornbread. They filled their plates, and she disappeared again. After a few bites in total silence, Jake asked, "Did you ever know Seth Hubbard?"
"I saw it in the paper this morning. Quite sad. I met him once or twice, 15 years ago. Some trifling legal matter. Never sued him, though, so I'll always regret that. He might have had some assets. I tried to sue everyone with assets, which, as you know, is a pretty damn small class around here. Why?"
"I have a hypothetical for you."
"Can't it wait? I'm eating."
"No, listen. You have some assets, no wife, no kids, some distant relatives, and you have a lovely black housekeeper who gives appearances of being something a little more than just a housekeeper."
"This sounds like meddling. Where are we going?"
"If you wrote a new will today, who might get your assets?"
"Damn sure wouldn't be you."
"No surprise. And I can assure you, you're not mentioned in my will either."
"No loss. By the way, you haven't paid last month's rent."
"Check's in the mail. Can you answer my question?"
"No, I don't like your question. Come on, play along. Humor me.
If you wrote a new will right now, who would get everything?" Lucian shoved cornbread into his mouth and chewed slowly. He glanced around to make sure Sally wasn't listening. Finally, he said,
"None of your business. Why?"
Jake reached into his coat pocket and whipped out some papers. "Get a load of this. The last will and testament of Seth Hubbard, written last Saturday in thoughtful consideration of what he was about to do on Sunday. The original arrived in my office mailbox on Monday." Lucian adjusted his reading glasses, sipped some lemonade, and read Seth's will. As he flipped to the second page, his face relaxed considerably, and he began to smile. He was nodding along with old Seth by the time he finished.
"I like it," he said, lowering it and grinning at Jake. "I'm assuming Letty is the black housekeeper."
"Correct. I met her yesterday for the first time." "Name ring a bell?" Lucian thought for a moment as he held the will and forgot about lunch.
"I don't recall any tables. Perhaps a Lang or two. Box Hill is a strange part of the county, and I never spent any time up there."
He read it again as Jake continued eating.
"What's he worth?"
Lucian asked as he refolded the sheets of paper and handed them back to Jake. $20 million, give or take, Jake said nonchalantly, as if that was the typical estate in Ford County. He did well in furniture and timber.
Evidently.
Now it's all in cash, for the most part. Lucian began laughing.
Just what this town needs, he said as he shook. A brand new black millionaire with more money than anyone else.
She doesn't have it yet, Jake said, enjoying the levity. I just met with some lawyers from the Rush firm, and they basically promised a war.
Of course. Wouldn't you fight over that kind of money?
Sure. I'd fight over a lot less.
So would I.
Did you ever handle a nasty will contest?
Oh, so that's where we're going. You need some free legal advice from a disbarred lawyer.
These cases are pretty rare. Lucian worked a mouthful and scratched his beard. He shook his head and said,
No, nothing. Look, the Wilbanks family has fought over its land and stocks and deposits for 100 years. Everything has been fought over, bitterly at times. There have been fistfights, divorces, suicides, duels, threats of murder. You name it, and a Wilbanks has done it. But we've always managed to keep it out of the courts.
Sally appeared and topped off their glasses. They ate in silence for a few minutes. Lucian was staring at the front lawn, his eyes glowing, his mind racing.
Fascinating, isn't it, Jake?
It is indeed.
And either side can demand a trial by jury, right?
Yes. The law has not been changed, and the request for a jury trial must be made before any hearing, so it must be dealt with soon. That's what I want you to ponder, Lucian. That's the big issue of the day. Do I play it before a jury, or do I trust Judge Attlee with the decision?
What if Attlee recuses himself?
He won't, because this case will be too much fun. The largest estate he'll ever see, a packed courtroom, high drama, and if there's a jury, then Attlee gets to preside over the circus while hiding behind its verdict.
You may be right.
The question is, can you trust a Ford County jury? 3 blacks, 4 at the most.
The Haley jury was all white, as I recall.
This is not Carl Lee Haley, Lucian. Far from it. That was all about race. This is all about money.
Everything is about race in Mississippi, Jake. Don't ever forget that. A simple black woman on the verge of inheriting what might be the largest fortune this county has ever seen, and the decision rests with a jury that's predominantly white? It's race and money, Jake. A rare combination around here.
So you wouldn't risk a jury?
I didn't say that. Allow me to consider this for a spell, okay? My valuable advice, though still free to you, often needs proper reflection.
Fair enough.
I might stop by this afternoon. I'm looking for an old book that might be in the attic.
You own the place, Jake said, shoving away his plate.
And you're late with the rent.
Sue me.
I'd love to, but you're broke. You're living in a rental house, and your car has almost as many miles as mine.
I guess I should have gone into the furniture business.
Anything but the law. I like this case, Jake. I might want to work on it.
Sure, Lucian, Jake managed to say without hesitation. Stop by late this afternoon and we'll chat. He stood and dropped his napkin on the table.
No coffee?
No, I need to run. Thanks for lunch, and pass along my regards to Sally. Chapter 11. A nosy paralegal sniffing through old land records down the hall heard the gossip as it drifted over from a water cooler and went to make copies of the latest will to be filed for probate in Ford County. Back at the office, he showed it to his bosses, made even more copies, and began faxing here and there. His bosses faxed it too, and by noon Wednesday, copies of Seth's two-page will were popping up all over the county. The perish in pain wish was a favorite touch, but speculation about the deceased's net worth soon dominated the discussion. As soon as Herschel left his father's home, he called his lawyer in Memphis to pass along the wonderful news that he would soon be inheriting several million dollars. Of particular concern was his ex-wife. He was still bleeding from the divorce, and he was curious if she could make a claim. No, she could not, his lawyer assured him. The lawyer called a lawyer friend down in Tupelo for no reason other than to spread rumors, and in doing so, managed to include the bit about Seth Hubbard having a net worth in excess of $20 million. The lawyer in Tupelo called some friends. The size of the estate began to grow. As soon as Ian Defoe got on the Natchez Trace Parkway and headed south, he set his cruise control on 50 and settled in for the pleasant drive. Traffic was light. The sun was up. The leaves were beginning to change, and some were dropping in the breeze. Though his wife, as always, was complicating his life, he had reason to smile. He had managed to defuse the divorce talk, at least for the moment. She was hungover, and she had just buried her father, and her nerves were shot anyway. And even on a good day, Ramona dealt poorly with adversity. He could pacify her, bring her around, kiss her ass enough to gloss over their problems, and set about the task of managing their new wealth. Together. He was certain he could handle this. She was lying across the rear seat, on her back with a forearm over her eyes, trying to sleep it off. She had stopped talking, and her breathing was heavy. He turned around often to make sure she was out of it. Then he carefully reached for his new car phone and called the office. Speaking as softly as possible, he offered only the minimum to Rodney, his partner. The old boy's gone. Estate somewhere north of 20 mil. Furniture and lumber. Pretty amazing. Had no idea. Just saw the will. 40% after taxes. Not bad. About a year. Not kidding. More later. Ian drove on, smiling at the foliage and dreaming of a better life. Even if they got a divorce, he'd still get a piece of her inheritance, right? He thought about calling his lawyer, but wisely decided to wait. The phone rang suddenly, startling him and waking up Ramona. "Hello," he said. On the other end, a stiff male voice said, "Yes, hello, Ian. Stillman Rush here. Hope I didn't disturb. We're on our way back to Tupelo." "Not at all. We're on a trace with a couple of hours to go. Nothing to do but talk." "Yes, well, look, there's been a slight complication, so I'll just go ahead and get right to the point." His voice had a nervous tinge to it, and Ian knew immediately that something was wrong. Ramona sat up in the rear seat and rubbed her swollen eyes. Stillman went on, "We didn't get the chance to open Mr. Hubbard's estate after we saw you this morning because another will has already been presented. Seems as though a lawyer in Clanton hustled over to the courthouse late yesterday afternoon and filed a handwritten will that Mr. Hubbard purportedly wrote last Saturday, the day before he died. Handwritten wills are still valid if they meet certain criteria. This will is just awful. It leaves nothing to the family. Ramona and Herschel are specifically cut out and instead gives 90% of the estate to Letty Lang, the housekeeper." "Letty?" Ian managed to gasp as he veered across the center line. He caught himself and yanked the wheel. "What is it?" Ramona snarled from the back seat. "Yes, Letty Lang," Stillman repeated. "I guess he was quite fond of her." "This is ridiculous," Ian said sharply, his voice already several octaves higher, his eyes glaring wildly into the rearview mirror. 90%? Did you say 90%?
"I did, yes. I have a copy of the will, and it clearly says 90%.
handwritten. Is it a forgery? We don't know at this point. Everything is preliminary. Well, obviously, Stillman, this can't stand up, can it? Of course not. We met with the attorney who probated the will, and he's not going to withdraw it, so we've agreed to meet with the judge soon and work things out. Work things out? What does that mean? Well, we'll ask the judge to toss out this handwritten will and probate the legitimate one we looked at this morning. If for some reason he says no, then we'll go to court and fight over which will should stand. When do we go to court? Ian asked belligerently, but there was also a noticeable layer of desperation in his voice, as if he could feel the fortune beginning to slide. We're not sure right now, but I'll call in a few days. We'll work this out, Ian. Damn right you will, or I'll bring in the Lanier firm from Jackson, the big boys. Been representing me for a long time. Those guys know how to litigate. In fact, I'll probably call Wade Lanier as soon as we hang up. No need for that, Ian. Not yet, anyway. The last thing we need at this point is more lawyers. I'll call you in a couple of days. You do that. Ian slammed the phone down and glared at his wife, who said, "What's going on, Ian?" Ian took a deep breath, exhaled, and said, "You're not going to believe it." Herschel was sitting behind the wheel of his small Datsun, listening to the end of a Springsteen song when the call came. The Datsun was parked near the main entrance of the BMW dealer in East Memphis. Dozens of shiny new BMWs glistened in perfect rows along the street. He had fought himself over this ridiculous stop and made peace only with a compromise that was to include a chat with the salesman, but certainly no test drive. Not yet, anyway. As he reached to turn off the radio, his car phone rang. It was Stillman Rush. He began with a nervous, "Herschel, there's a new wrinkle." Letty arrived alone. Jake followed her up the stairs to the big office, where he closed the door and directed her to a small sitting area with a sofa and chairs. He took off his tie and poured coffee and tried to ease her apprehension. She explained that Simeon had already left again. She had told him nothing about Seth's will, and this angered him. They had fought briefly, with every word echoing around the crowded house, and so he left. Jake handed her a copy of Seth's will. She read it and began crying. He placed a box of tissues next to her chair. She read it again, and when she finished, she laid it on the coffee table before her and sat for a long time with her face in her hands. When the tears stopped, she wiped her cheeks and sat straighter, as if the shock was gone and she was ready for business. "Why would he do this, Letty?" Jake asked firmly.
"I don't know. I swear I don't know,"
she said, her voice low and hoarse. "Did he discuss this will with you?"
"No."
"Have you seen this before?" She was shaking her head.
"No, no."
"Has he ever mentioned his will to you?" A pause as she tried to unscramble her thoughts.
"Twice, maybe in the past few months. He said he would leave a little something behind for me. But he never said what. Of course, I was hoping he would, but I never brought it up. I never had no will. My mama never had one. Not something we think about, you know, Mr. Brigance."
"Please, call me Jake."
"I try."
"Did you call him Mr. Hubbard, Mr. Seth, or just Seth?"
Deliberately, she said, "When it was just the two of us, I called him Seth, because that's what he wanted. If anybody else was around, I always called him Mr. Seth or Mr. Hubbard."
"What did he call you?"
"Letty, always."
He quizzed her about Seth's last days, his illness, treatments, doctors, nurses, appetite, daily rituals, and her employment. She knew almost nothing about his business and said that he kept his papers locked up tight around the house, Most had been moved to his office over the past few months. He never discussed business with her or in her presence. Before he got sick, and afterward when he felt well, he traveled a lot and preferred to be out of town. His home was quiet, lonely, and not a happy place. Often she would arrive at 8 a.m. with nothing to do for the next 8 hours, especially if Seth were out of town. When he was there, she cooked and cleaned. When he was sick and dying, she stayed by his side. She fed him, and yes, she bathed him and cleaned up after him when necessary. There had been dark periods, especially during the chemo and radiation, when he was bedridden and too weak to feed himself. Jake delicately explained the concept of undue influence. The legal assault on the handwritten will would be an assault on Letty, with allegations that she was too close to Seth, had too much influence, that she manipulated him into including her. For Letty to prevail, it would be important for her to prove otherwise. As they talked, and as she began to relax, Jake could envision her deposition in the near future, in a room full of hyped-up lawyers, all clamoring for the floor and the chance to grill her about what she and Mr. Hubbard did and did not do. He already felt sorry for her. When she was composed and under control, he said, "I need to explain the relationships here, Letty. I am not your lawyer. I am the lawyer for Mr. Hubbard's estate, and in that capacity, it's my job to advocate in favor of this will and to follow its terms. I have to work with the executor, and we're assuming it will be Mr. Amberg, to do certain things the law requires, such as notifying potential creditors, protecting assets, preparing an inventory of everything he owned, and so forth. If the will is contested, and I'm sure it will be, then it's my job to go into court and fight to uphold this will. I'm not your lawyer because you are a beneficiary of the will, the same as his brother, Ansel Hubbard, and the same as his church. However, you and I are on the same side here because we both want this will to prevail. Does this make any sense?"
"I suppose. Do I need a lawyer?"
"Not really, not at this point. Don't hire a lawyer until you need one." The vultures would soon be circling, and the courtroom would get crowded. Drop $20 million on the table and get out of the way.
"Will you tell me if I need one?"
she asked innocently. "Yes, I will," Jake said, though he had no idea how he would give such advice. He poured more coffee and noticed she had not touched hers. He glanced at his watch. They had been together for 30 minutes, and she had yet to ask about the size of the estate. A white person wouldn't have made it 5 minutes without such an inquiry. At times, she seemed to absorb each word, and at times, she seemed to deflect them, as if overwhelmed. She cried again and wiped her cheeks. "Are you curious about how much?" Jake asked.
"I figured you'd tell me sooner or later."
"I've seen nothing in the way of financial statements. I've not been inside his office, though that should happen soon. But according to Mr. Amberg, Seth Hubbard recently sold his company and cleared about $20 million. Mr. Amberg thinks this is probably sitting in a bank somewhere, cash. Plus there are a few other assets, maybe some real estate here and there. One of my jobs is to locate everything and inventory it for the court and for the beneficiaries."
"And I'm one of those? A beneficiary?"
"Oh, yes. Very much so. 90%.
90% of 20 million?
"Yes, give or take."
"Oh, my God, Jake."
She reached for the tissues and collapsed again. Over the next hour, they managed some progress. Between her emotional meltdowns, Jake laid out the basics of estate administration. Time, the people involved, court appearances, taxes, and lastly, the transfer of assets. The more he talked, though, the more confused she became, and he suspected that much of what he was saying would be repeated soon. He dumbed down the issues involved in a will contest and made cautious predictions as to what might happen. Knowing Judge Attlee and his distaste of lingering cases and slow lawyers, Jake believed a trial, assuming there was one, would take place within the next 12 months, probably sooner. With so much at stake, the losing party would certainly appeal, so tack on 2 more years before a final outcome. As Letty began to grasp the ordeal and how long it might take, her resolve stiffened, and she gathered her emotions. Twice she asked if there was any way to keep it all quiet. No, Jake explained patiently, that would not be possible. She feared Simeon and his family of outlaws and wondered if she should move away. Jake had no advice on that matter, but he had already envisioned the coming chaos in her life as kinfolks materialized and new friends came out of the woods. After 2 hours, she reluctantly left. Jake escorted her to the front door, where she looked through the glass, across the sidewalk and the street, as if she preferred to stay inside where she knew it was safe. She had been jolted by the will, then overwhelmed by the law, and at that moment Jake was the only person she trusted. Her eyes were wet again when she finally stepped out.
"Are those tears of joy, or is she scared to death?" Roxy asked after Jake closed the door.
"Both, I would say." She waved a pink phone message slip and said,
"Doofus Lee called. He's hot on the trail."
"Oh, come on."
"Not kidding. Said he might stop by this afternoon and poke around in Seth Hubbard's dirty laundry."
"What's dirty about it?" Jake asked as he took the slip.
"Everything's dirty to Doofus."
Doofus Lee wrote for the Ford County Times and was famous for screwing up the facts and barely dodging libel suits. While sloppy and easily avoidable, his errors were usually minor and harmless and had never risen to the level of outright defamation. He butchered dates and names and places, but had never seriously embarrassed anyone. He had an ear for the street, an uncanny nose for picking up a story immediately after it happened or while it was unfolding, and though he was too lazy for prolonged digging, he could be counted on to stir things up. He preferred to cover the courthouse, primarily because it was across the street from the newspaper's offices, and many of its records were public. He strode into the law offices of Jake Brigance late Wednesday afternoon, took a chair near Roxy's desk, and demanded to see the lawyer.
"I know he's here,"
he said with a killer smile that Roxy ignored. He liked the ladies and labored under the permanent illusion that every woman was eyeing him.
"He's busy," she said. "So am I."
He opened a magazine and began whistling softly. 10 minutes later, Roxy said,
"He'll see you now."
Jake and Doofus had known each other for years and never had a problem. Jake was one of the few lawyers around the square who had never threatened to sue him, and Doofus appreciated it.
"Tell me about Seth Hubbard,"
he said, pulling out his notepad and uncapping his pen. "I assume you've seen the will," Jake replied.
"Got a copy. They're everywhere. How much is he worth?"
"Nothing. He's dead."
"Ha ha. His estate, then?"
"I can't say anything, Doofus, at this time. I don't know much, and I can't say anything."
"Okay. Let's go off the record."
With Doofus, nothing was off the record, and every lawyer, judge, and clerk knew it. "I'm not off the record. I'm not on the record. I'm not talking, Doofus. It's that simple. Maybe later."
"When are you going to court?"
"The funeral was yesterday, okay? There's no rush."
Oh, really? No rush. Why did you file your petition 20 minutes after the funeral was over?
Jake paused. Nailed. Busted. Great question. Okay, maybe I had a reason to rush my petition.
The old race to the courthouse, huh?
Dumas said with a goofy smirk as he scribbled something on his pad. No comment.
I can't find Letty Lang. Any idea where she is?
No comment. And she will not talk to you or any other reporter.
We'll see. I tracked down a guy in Atlanta, writes for a business magazine, said an LBO group bought a holding company owned by Mr. Seth Hubbard for $55 million. Happened late last year. Ring a bell?
No comment, Dumas, Jake said, impressed that the notoriously lazy reporter had been working the phones.
I'm not much when it comes to business, but you gotta figure the old guy had some debts, you know? No comment, right?
Jake nodded yes, no comment.
But I can't locate his banks. The more I dig, the less I learn about your client.
Never met the man, Jake said, then wished he hadn't. Dumas wrote it down.
Do you know if he had any debts? Mr. Amberg clammed up, then he hung up.
No comment.
So if I say that Mr. Hubbard sold out for $55 million, and don't mention any debts because I have no sources, then my readers will get the impression that his estate is worth a lot more than it really is, right?
Jake nodded. Dumas watched him, waited, then scribbled. Shifting gears, he asked,
So the great question, Jake, is why would a man who's worth millions change his will the day before his suicide, screwing his family with the update and leaving everything to his housekeeper?
You got it, Dumas. That is the great question. Jake kept nodding, but said nothing.
And perhaps number two might be, what did Seth and his little brother witness that left such an impression that Seth mentions it decades later, right?
Jake replied, That's indeed a great question, but I'm not sure it's number two.
Fair enough. Any idea where Ansel Hubbard is these days?
None whatsoever.
I found a cousin in Tupelo who says the family has assumed he's been dead for decades.
I have not had time to search for Ansel.
But you will?
Yes. He's a beneficiary under the will. It's my job to locate him if possible, or find out what happened to him.
And how will you go about this?
I have no idea. Haven't really thought about it yet.
When's the first court date?
It has not been set.
Will you get your girl to contact me when a date has been set?
Yes, unless it's a closed hearing.
Fair enough.
Jake's last visitor of the afternoon was his landlord. Lucian was in the conference room on the first floor where the law books were kept. He had covered the table with them, obviously lost somewhere deep in his own world. When Jake walked in, said hello, and saw a dozen books opened, he took a deep breath as a sense of dread hit him in the gut. He could not remember the last time Lucian dug through law books. The disbarment had happened not long after Jake hired on, and Lucian had kept his distance from the office and from the law. Now he was back. Some light reading? Jake asked as he fell into a leather chair.
Just brushing up on probate law. Never did much of it. Pretty dull stuff, unless, of course, you get a case like this. I can't decide if you want a jury or not.
I'm leaning toward a jury, but everything is premature.
Of course.
Lucian closed a book and slid it away.
You said you were meeting with Letty Lang this afternoon. How did it go?
Fine, Lucian. And you know as well as I do that I cannot talk about our confidential discussions.
Oh, sure. Do you like her?
Jake paused a second and reminded himself to be patient. Yes, she's a nice person who's easily overwhelmed. This is overwhelming, to say the least.
But will a jury like her?
You mean white jurors?
I don't know. I understand black people far better than most whites. I'm not a racist, Jake. I'm one of at least a dozen whites in this county not blinded by racism. I was the first and only white member of the NAACP here. At one time, almost all of my clients were black. I know black people, Jake, and having blacks on this jury could cause trouble.
Lucian, the funeral was yesterday. Isn't this a bit premature?
Maybe. But these conversations will take place eventually. You're lucky to have someone like me on your side, Jake. Humor me. Talk to me. A lot of blacks will be jealous of Letty Lang because now she's one of them. But if she gets the money, she'll be the richest person in Ford County. There are no rich black people around here. It's unheard of. She won't be black anymore. She'll be uppity and rich, and she'll look down on everybody. Especially her people. Do you follow me, Jake?
To some degree, yes. But I'd still rather have blacks on the jury. They'll be more sympathetic than a bunch of rednecks who can barely pay their mortgages.
No rednecks either.
Jake laughed and asked, well, if you eliminate the blacks and the rednecks, who exactly will you seat on your perfect jury?
I'm still working on that. I like this case, Jake. I've thought about nothing else since lunch. It has reminded me of why I once loved the law.
He leaned forward on his elbows and looked at Jake as if he might get choked up.
I want to be in that courtroom, Jake.
You're getting ahead of yourself, Lucian. A trial, if it happens, is months away.
Sure, I know that. But you'll need some help, and lots of it. I'm bored, Jake. Tired of sitting on the porch and drinking. And I've got to cut back on the booze. I'm worried about it, Jake. I'll be honest with you.
And with good reason.
I'd like to hang out around here. I'll stay out of the way. I know most people avoid me, and I understand why. Hell, I'd avoid me if I could. It'll give me something to do. Keep me away from the bottle, at least during the day. And I know so much more about the law than you do, anyway. And I want to be in that courtroom.
This for the second time, and Jake knew it would not go away. The courtroom was a large, stately room with different sections and lots of seating. Did he want to sit with the spectators and watch the show? Or was he thinking of a seat at the table with the other lawyers? Because if he was, then Jake's life was about to become messy. If Lucian wanted to be a lawyer again, he would be required to suffer through the ordeal of the bar exam. If successful, he would have a license to practice, which, of course, would usher him back into Jake's professional life. The image of Lucian sitting at counsel table, not 15 feet from the jury box, was frightening. To most whites, he was a toxic legend, a crazy old drunk who had embarrassed a once proud family and now shacked up with his housekeeper.
We'll see, Jake said cautiously.
Chapter 12. The Honorable Reuben V. Attlee was recovering from his third heart attack, with the recovery expected to be full, if one can physically feel complete after so much cardiac damage. He was gaining strength and endurance, and there was evidence of this in the flow of his docket. There were clear signs he was regaining his stride. Lawyers were getting barked at. Deadlines were being enforced. Long-winded witnesses were being cut off. Perjurers were being threatened with jail. Litigants pursuing frivolous claims were finding themselves bounced out of court. Along the hallways of the courthouse, lawyers and clerks and even janitors were saying, "He's back." He had been on the bench for 30 years and now ran unopposed every 4 years. He was neither a Democrat nor a Republican, liberal nor conservative, Baptist nor Catholic. He pulled for neither State nor Ole Miss. He had no favorites, no leanings, no preconceived notions about anything or any person. He was a judge, as open, tolerant, and fair-minded as he could possibly be, given his upbringing and genetic composition. He ran his courtroom with a heavy hand, quick to scold an unprepared lawyer, but equally quick to help a struggling one. He could show incredible compassion when it was needed, and he had a mean streak that terrified every lawyer in the county, perhaps with the exception of Harry Rex Vonner. 9 days after Seth hung himself, Judge Attlee assumed the bench in the main courtroom and said good morning. In Jake's opinion, he looked as fit as ever, which was not altogether that healthy, but fine given his history. He was a big man, over 6 feet tall, with a protruding midsection that he hid well under his black robe. "A nice crowd," Judge Attlee said with amusement as he scanned the courtroom. With so many lawyers, seating had been a problem. Jake had arrived early and staked his claim to the plaintiff's table, where he now sat with Russell Amberg, who had informed Jake that morning that he wanted out. Close behind them, and on their side, but not exactly on their team, was Letty Lang. On each side of Letty, there was a lawyer, both black, both from Memphis. Jake's world had been rattled the day before when he heard the news that Letty had hired Booker Sistrunk, an infamous bomb thrower whose entry into this case would greatly complicate matters. Jake had tried to call her. He was still stunned by her decision. It was an extremely unwise one. Across the way and tucked tight around the defense table was an assemblage of lawyers in nice suits. Beyond the bar, and scattered across the rows of ancient wooden pews, there was an impressive crowd. Its collective curiosity piqued. Judge Attlee said,
"Before we get started, it's best to understand where we are and what we'd like to accomplish here today. We're not here because of a motion filed by anyone. That'll happen later. Today our goal is to put together a plan to proceed. As I understand it, Mr. Seth Hubbard left two wills, one offered for probate by you, Mr. Brigance, a handwritten will dated October 1st of this year."
Jake nodded, but did not stand. If a lawyer spoke to Judge Attlee, that lawyer had better be on his or her feet. Nodding from a chair was acceptable, barely.
"And a second will, dated September 7th of last year, though this will was expressly revoked by the handwritten will. Now, does anyone know of another will? Any chance Mr. Hubbard left another surprise?"
He paused for only a second as his large brown eyes swept around the courtroom. A pair of cheap, thick-rimmed reading glasses stuck to the end of his nose.
"Good. Didn't think so."
He shuffled some papers and made a note.
"Okay, let's start over here. Please stand, give me your name, and let's meet one another."
He was pointing at Jake, so he stood and stated his name. Russell Amberg stood next and gave his name.
"And you're the executor in the handwritten will?" Judge Attlee asked as a formality. "Yes, sir. But I'd prefer to skip all this," Amberg said. "We'll have plenty of time to deal with it later. And you in the light gray suit."
The taller black lawyer stood purposefully and buttoned the top button of his tailored suit.
"Yes, Your Honor. My name is Booker Sistrunk, and along with my partner here, Mr. Kendrick Boast, we represent the interests of Ms. Letty Lang."
Sistrunk touched her shoulder. Boast stood, and both lawyers towered over her. She shouldn't have been there, not at this stage. She belonged beyond the bar on the benches with the rest of the spectators. But Sistrunk and Boast had jostled her into position and dared anyone to object. Had it been a proper motion hearing, Judge Attlee would have quickly put her in her place. But he wisely ignored the impropriety.
"I don't believe I've had the honor of seeing you gentlemen in my courtroom before," Judge Attlee said in a suspicious tone. "Where are you from?"
"Our firm is in Memphis," Sistrunk replied, though everyone knew it.
These days, in the Memphis press, their firm was getting more ink than the next five combined. They were at war with the Memphis Police Department and were winning brutality cases monthly, it seemed. Sistrunk was riding a wave of notoriety. He was loud, brash, divisive, and was proving to be a highly effective race baiter in a city that had produced many. Jake knew Simeon had kinfolks in Memphis. One thing had evidently led to another, and Jake had received the dreadful call from Booker Sistrunk. They were entering the case, which meant another layer of intense scrutiny of Jake's work, along with another finger in the pie. There were already troubling stories of cars parked in Letty's front yard and vultures lounging on the front porch. Judge Atlee continued,
"I'm assuming, then, that you have a license to practice law in this state?"
"No, sir, not as of this morning. But we will associate local counsel."
"That would be a wise move, Mr. Sistrunk. The next time you appear in my court, I expect to know the lawyer you're with."
"Yes, sir," Sistrunk said stiffly, almost with a sneer.
He and Bost sat down and squeezed next to their valuable client. Before the hearing began, Jake had tried to say good morning to Letty, but her lawyers had shielded her. She would not make eye contact.
"Over here,"
Judge Atlee said, pointing to the crowded defense table. Stillman Rush was quick to rise and say,
"Yes, Your Honor. I'm Stillman Rush with the Rush Firm in Tupelo, and I'm here with Sam Larkin and Lewis McGuire."
Both men stood on cue and nodded politely to the bench. They knew Judge Atlee. Longer introductions were not needed.
"And your firm prepared the 1987 will, is that correct?"
"That is true," Stillman said with a generous, sappy smile.
"Very well. Next."
A large man with a round, hairless head stood and growled,
"Your Honor, I'm Wade Lanier of the Lanier Firm in Jackson. I'm here with my associate, Lester Chilcutt, and we represent the interest of Ms. Ramona Defoe, daughter of the deceased. Her husband, Ian Defoe, is a longtime client of our firm, and that's enough, Mr. Lanier,"
Judge Atlee barked, rudely cutting him off. "Welcome to Ford County.
I didn't ask about your other clients or your firm."
The presence of Wade Lanier was also disturbing. Jake knew him by reputation only, but that was enough to dread dealing with him. Big firm, hardball tactics, enough success to fuel the ego and keep it hungry. Judge Atlee pointed again and said,
"And you, sir?"
A man in a gaudy sports coat jumped up and announced,
"Yes, well, Your Honor, my name is D-Jack O'Malley, and I represent Mr. Herschel Hubbard, surviving son of the deceased. My client lives in Memphis, and that's where I'm from, but I will most certainly associate local counsel the next time I'm here."
"Good idea. Next."
Wedged into a spot behind O'Malley was a thin, rat-faced young man with wild, wiry hair. He stood timidly, as if he had never addressed a judge before, and said in a squeaky voice,
"Sir, I'm Zach Zeitler, also from Memphis, and I've been hired to represent the interest of the children of Herschel Hubbard."
Judge Atlee nodded and said, "So, the grandkids have lawyers, too?"
"Yes, sir. They are beneficiaries under the prior will."
"Got it. And I'm assuming they are in the courtroom?"
"They are."
"Thank you, Mr. Zeitler. And if you haven't already figured things out, next time you're here, please bring a local lawyer. God knows we'll need some more. Unless, of course, you are licensed in this state."
"I am, Your Honor."
"Very well.
Next." Leaning against a railing in a corner, chairless, a lawyer glanced around and said,
"Yes, Your Honor. I'm Joe Bradley Hunt with the Skoll Firm in Jackson, and..."
"Which firm?"
"Skoll, Your Honor. Skoll, Rumpke, Ratliff, Bodini, and Zacharias. Sorry I asked."
"Continue."
"And we represent the interest of the two minor children of Ramona and Ian Defoe, grandchildren of the deceased.
Okay. Anyone else?
Necks craned and eyes scanned the crowd. Judge Attlee did some quick math and said,
A dozen. I count 11 lawyers so far, and there is no reason to believe there won't be more.
He shuffled some papers and looked at the spectators in the courtroom. To his left, behind Jake and Letty, there was a crowd of black people, including Simeon, their kids and grandkids, some cousins and aunts, Cypress, a preacher, and a lot of friends, old and new, who were there to provide moral support for Letty as she took the first step in fighting for what was rightfully hers. To His Honor's right, across the aisle, behind the throng of lawyers gearing up to oppose the last will, there was a crowd of white people, including Ian and Ramona and their two children, Herschel and his two kids, his ex-wife, though she was on the back row as far away as possible, Dumas Lee and another reporter, and the usual collection of courthouse regulars who rarely missed a trial or a contested hearing. Deputy Prather stood at the main door, sent there by Ozzie to hear it all and report back later. Lucian Wilbank sat on the back row on the black side, partially hidden by a beefy young man in front of him. He and Attlee went back many years, and Lucian did not want to be a distraction. Minutes before they began, Jake had attempted to politely introduce himself to Herschel and Ramona, but they had rudely turned their backs. He was the enemy now, not their father. Ian, in particular, looked as if he might throw a punch. Their teenage children were turned out in the finest preppy fashions and gave every impression of bearing the arrogance of inherited wealth. Herschel's two children, on the contrary, were ill-kempt and grungy. Just days earlier, the four had been too busy to attend the funeral of their beloved grandfather. Now, though, their priorities had suddenly shifted. Jake figured the lawyers had impressed upon the families the need for the kids to be there, to be seen, to be closely identified with the consequences of the court's actions. A waste of time, in his opinion, but then the stakes were high. At the moment, in a crowded courtroom, Jake felt very alone. Next to him, Russell Amberg was uncooperative, hardly civil, and planning a quick exit from the proceedings. Behind him, only inches away, sat Letty, a person he thought he could talk to. She, though, was being guarded by a couple of pit bull lawyers who were ready for an alley fight over the fortune. And these were the people on his side of the room. Across the aisle, an entire pack of hyenas was waiting to pounce. Judge Attlee said,
I've read both wills. We will proceed with the last one. The handwritten will dated October 1st. A petition to probate it was filed on October 4th. Mr. Brigance, you will begin the administration of the estate as required by law, posting the notification to creditors, filing a preliminary inventory, and so on. I expect this to be done promptly. Mr. Amberg, I understand you wish to step aside.
Amberg slowly stood and said,
That's right, Judge. I have no stomach for this. As the executor, I would be required to take an oath in which I swear that this is the valid last will and testament of Seth Hubbard, and I simply refuse to take that oath. I don't like this will, and I won't know part of it. Mr. Brigance?
Jake stood next to his soon-to-be ex-client and said,
Your Honor, Mr. Amberg was once a lawyer, and he knows the basics of probate. I will prepare an order allowing him to withdraw, and at the same time I'll submit names for his replacement. Please make this a priority. I want the administration to proceed while we sort out other matters. Regardless of what happens to the holographic will or the prior one, the estate of Mr. Hubbard needs tending to. I assume there are several parties who intend to contest this will. Am I right?
A squad of lawyers stood, nodding. and Judge Attlee held up his hand.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Mr. Amberg, you may be excused.
Amberg managed a terse thanks as he scampered from the plaintiff's table and hurried down the aisle. Judge Attlee adjusted his glasses and said,
We will proceed as follows. Mr. Bergantz, you have 10 days to find a substitute executor, and according to the wishes of the deceased, let's make sure it's not a lawyer from this county. Once the executor is in place, you and he will begin the task of locating assets and identifying liabilities. I would like a preliminary inventory as soon as possible. In the meantime, the rest of you should file your objections to this will. Once all parties have properly joined in opposition, we will meet again and map out a plan for the trial. As you know, either side may demand a trial by jury. If you so wish, then please make this demand timely when you file your objection. Will contests proceed like all other civil trials in Mississippi, so the rules of evidence and procedure will apply.
He removed his glasses and chewed on a stem as he surveyed the lawyers.
Since we are headed for a trial, I'll tell y'all right now that I will not preside over one with a dozen lawyers. I cannot envision such a nightmare, nor will I subject a jury, if we do in fact have one, to such abuse. We will define the issues, streamline the procedure, and try the case in an efficient manner. Any questions?
Oh, 1,000 questions, but there would be plenty of time to ask them later. Suddenly, Booker Sistrunk rose, and in his booming baritone said,
Your Honor, I'm not sure what's appropriate at this time, but I would like to suggest that my client, Letty Lang, be appointed as the substitute executor to take the place of Mr. Amberg. I have reviewed the law of this state and have found no provision requiring a lawyer or an accountant or the like to serve in this role. Indeed, the law sets forth no requirements for training or experience for one to serve as either an administrator in the case of an estate with no will or an executor in a case like this.
Sistrunk spoke slowly, carefully, with perfect diction, and his words boomed around the courtroom. Judge Attlee and the rest of the lawyers listened and watched. The words were true. Technically, anyone could be named to take the place of Russell Amberg, any sane person over the age of 18. Not even criminals were excluded. However, given the size of the estate and the complex issues facing it, a more experienced, dispassionate hand would be needed. The notion of putting Letty in charge of a $20 million estate with Sistrunk whispering in her ear was shocking, at least to the white people in the courtroom. Even Judge Attlee seemed frozen for a second or two. Sistrunk wasn't finished. He paused just long enough for the initial shock to register, then continued,
Now, Your Honor, I know that virtually all the probate work is done by the estate's lawyer, under the strict supervision of the court, of course, and for that reason, I'd suggest that my firm be designated as counsel of record in this matter. We will work closely with our client, Ms. Letty Lang, to follow the precise dictates of Mr. Hubbard's wishes. If necessary, we will consult with Mr. Bergantz, a fine young lawyer in his own right, but most of the heavy lifting will be done by me and my staff.
And with that, Booker Sistrunk accomplished his goal. The war would now be defined in terms of black versus white. Herschel and Ramona and their families glared with hatred across the aisle at the group of blacks who eagerly and somewhat smugly returned the looks. Their girl, Letty, had been chosen to receive the money, and they were there to fight for her. But the money belonged to the Hubbards. Seth had been out of his mind. Jake, stunned, shot a fierce look over his shoulder, but was ignored by Sistrunk. Jake's first reaction was, "How stupid! A predominantly white county means a predominantly white jury." They were a long way from Memphis, where Sistrunk had proven skillful at getting his people on federal juries and winning huge verdicts. But Memphis was another world. Put 9 or 10 white folks from Ford County on the jury, make them suffer through a week with Booker Sistrunk, and Ms. Letty Lang would leave with nothing. The horde of white lawyers sat as stunned as Jake, but Wade Lanier quickly saw the opportunity. He jumped to his feet and blurted, "We have no objection, Your Honor." Judge Atlee snapped, "You have no standing to object to anything." Jake's second thought was, "Fine, get me out of here. With this pack of vultures, there will be nothing left. Life is too short to waste a year dodging bullets in a race war." Judge Atlee said, "Anything else, Mr. Sistrunk?"
"Well, not at this time, Your Honor."
Sistrunk turned and looked smugly at Simeon and the family. He had just proven his backbone. He was fearless, could not be intimidated, and was ready for a street brawl. They had hired the right lawyer. Before he sat, he shot a glance at Herschel Hubbard, and with a smirk seemed to say, "Game on, old boy." Judge Atlee calmly said, "You need to keep researching, Mr. Sistrunk. Our probate laws give supreme deference to the wishes of the person who wrote the will. Mr. Hubbard clearly stated his intentions with regard to the attorney he wanted. There will be no change in that regard. Any other requests you may have should be dealt with by proper motion. That is, once you have associated a lawyer recognized by this court and are duly before it." Jake began to breathe normally again, though he was still shaken by the brazenness of Sistrunk and his ideas, and his greed. There was little doubt he had signed up Letty to some form of contingency agreement that gave him a cut of her take. Most plaintiff's lawyers took 1/3 of a settlement, 40% of a jury verdict, and half where the case was appealed. An ego like Sistrunk, and admittedly one with a history of winning, would doubtless be at the top end of those percentages. And if that were not enough, he was craving another pile of cash to be earned by the hour as the probate attorney. Judge Atlee was finished. He picked up his gavel, said, "We'll meet again in 30 days, adjourned," and slammed it onto the surface of his bench. Letty was immediately engulfed by her attorneys, who whisked her away through the railing of the bar and to the front row, where she was circled by her family and other clingers. As if her life were in danger, they huddled around, stroking her, cooing, offering encouragement. Sistrunk was admired and congratulated for his bold assertions and positions, while Kendrick Boast kept an arm on Letty's shoulder as she whispered gravely to her loved ones. Cypress, her mother, sat in a wheelchair and wiped tears from her cheeks. What an awful thing they were putting the family through. Jake was in no mood for small talk, not that anyone tried to engage him. The other lawyers broke off into small pockets of conversation as they repacked their briefcases and prepared to leave. The Hubbard heirs clung together and tried to avoid glaring at the blacks who were after their money. Jake ducked through a side door and was headed for the back stairs when Mr. Pate, the ancient courtroom deputy, called,
"Say, Jake, Judge Atlee wants to see you."
In the small, cramped room where lawyers gathered for coffee and judges held their off-the-record meetings, Judge Atlee was removing his robe.
"Close the door," he said when Jake walked in.
The judge was no raconteur, no teller of tall legal tales, no jokester.
There was little bullshit, and rarely was there humor, though as a judge, he had an audience eager to laugh at anything.
"Have a seat, Jake,"
he said, and both sat at a small desk.
"What an ass," Judge Atlee said. "That might work in Memphis, but not here."
I think I'm still stunned.
"Do you know Quince Lundy, lawyer down in Smithfield?"
"I've heard of him."
"Old guy, maybe even semi-retired. He's done nothing but probate work for 100 years. Really knows his stuff and straight as an arrow. Old friend of mine. File a motion suggesting Quince and two others. You pick 'em as the substitute executor, and I'll appoint Quince. You'll get along fine with him. As for you, you're on board until the end. What's your hourly rate?"
"I don't have one, Judge. My clients work for $10 an hour if they're lucky. They can't afford to pay a lawyer $100.
"I think $150 is a fair rate in today's market. You agree?"
$150 sounds fine, Judge.
"Okay. You're on the clock at $150 an hour. I'm assuming you have the time."
"Oh, yes."
"Good. Because this will eat up your life for the near future. Every 60 days or so, file a petition and ask for attorney's fees. I'll make sure you get paid."
"Thanks, Judge."
"There are a lot of rumors about the size of the estate. Any idea what's true?"
"Russell Amberg says it's at least $20 million, with most of that in cash, hidden out of state. Otherwise, everyone in Clanton would know exactly."
"We'd better move fast to protect it. I'll sign an order giving you the authority to take possession of Mr. Hubbard's financial records. Once Quince Lundy is on board, you guys can start digging."
"Yes, sir." Judge Atlee took a long sip of coffee from a paper cup. He looked through a dirty window, seemed to gaze upon the courthouse lawn, and finally said,
"I almost feel sorry for that poor woman. She's lost all control, surrounded by people who smell money. She won't have a dime when Sis Drunk gets finished with her."
"Assuming the jury finds in her favor."
"Will you request a jury, Jake?"
"I don't know yet. Should I?" The question was far out of bounds, but at the moment it didn't seem so. Jake braced himself for the reprimand, but instead Judge Atlee managed a tight grin as he continued staring at nothing outside.
"I'd rather have a jury, Jake. I don't mind making tough decisions. That goes with the job. But in a case like this, it'll be nice to have 12 of our good and faithful citizens in the hot seat. I'd like that for a change."
His grin became a smile.
"I don't blame you. I'll make the request." "You do that. And Jake, there are a lot of lawyers out there, and few that I really trust. Don't hesitate to stop by and say hello and drink coffee if something needs to be discussed. I'm sure you appreciate the significance of this case. There's not much money around here, Jake. Never has been. Now, suddenly, there's a pot of gold, and a lot of people want some of it. You don't. I don't. But there are plenty of others. It's important that you and I stay on the same page."
Jake's muscles relaxed for the first time in hours, and he breathed deeply.
"I agree, Judge. And thanks. I'll see you around."
Chapter 13. Dumas Lee owned the front page of the Ford County Times on Wednesday, October 12th. The hearing the day before was evidently the only news in the county. A bold headline announced, "Battle Lines Drawn Over Hubbard Will," and Dumas kicked off the lead story in his finest tabloid fashion. A courtroom full of expectant heirs and their eager lawyers squared off yesterday in front of Chancellor Reuben Atlee as the opening shots were fired in what promises to be an epic battle for the fortune of the late Seth Hubbard, who hung himself on October 2nd. A photographer had been busy. In the center of the front page was a large photo of Letty Lang, as she was walking into the courthouse, with both Booker Sistrunk and Kendrick Boast tugging at her as if she were an invalid. Under the photo, she was described as Letty Lang, age 47, of Box Hill, former housekeeper of Seth Hubbard, and presumed beneficiary under his last handwritten and suspicious will, accompanied by her two lawyers from Memphis. Next to it were two smaller candid shots of Herschel and Ramona, also walking somewhere near the courthouse. Jake read the paper at his desk early Wednesday morning. He sipped coffee, read every word twice looking for mistakes, and was surprised to see Dumas got his facts straight for a change. But he cussed him for using the word suspicious. Every registered voter in the county was a potential juror. The majority would either read the paper or hear someone talking about it, and out of the gate, Dumas had declared the will to be suspicious. The scowling, smirking faces of the well-dressed intruders from Memphis didn't help matters either. As Jake stared at the photo, he tried to imagine a jury of 9 whites and 3 blacks trying to find sympathy for Letty as $20 million hung in the balance. They would find little. After a week in the courtroom with Booker Sistrunk, they would see through his intentions and void the will. A jury might grow to dislike Herschel and Ramona, but at least they were white and weren't being led by a shyster with the appeal of a TV preacher. Jake reminded himself that they were, for the moment, on the same team, or at least the same side of the courtroom. He vowed to quit. If Judge Attlee allowed Sistrunk to stay in the game, Jake would withdraw and go look for an ambulance to chase. Anything would be better than a brutal trial in which he was destined to lose. He needed the fees, but not the headaches. There was a commotion downstairs, then footsteps. There was an unmistakable rhythm and clatter to the way Harry Rex climbed the old wooden stairs to Jake's office. His steps were slow and heavy, and each seemed determined to shatter boards. The stairwell shook. Roxy called after him, protesting. Badly overweight and pathetically out of shape, he was almost gasping when he kicked open Jake's door and began with a friendly, "Damn woman's gone crazy." He tossed a copy of the newspaper onto Jake's desk. "Morning, Harry Rex," Jake said as his friend collapsed in a chair and worked on his heavy breathing. Each gasp a bit softer, each exhalation delaying cardiac arrest. "Is she trying to piss off everybody?" he asked. "It sure looks that way. You want some coffee?" "Got a Bud Light." "It's 9 o'clock in the morning." "So? I'm not going to court today. On days off, I'm starting earlier." "Do you think you're drinking too much?" "Hell no. With my clients, I'm not drinking enough. Neither are you." "I don't keep beer in the office. Don't keep it at home." "What a life." Harry Rex suddenly reached forward, grabbed the newspaper, held it up, and pointed to the photo of Letty. "Tell me something, Jake. What does the average white person in this county say when he sees this photo? You got a black housekeeper who's looking all right, and she somehow got herself inserted into the old boy's will. And now she's hired these slick African lawyers from the big city to come down here and grab the money. How does this play over at the coffee shop?"
"I think you know."
"Is she stupid?"
"No, but they got to her. Simeon has kinfolks in Memphis, and somehow a connection was made. She has no idea what she's doing, and she's getting bad advice."
"You're on her side, Jake. Can't you talk to her?"
He tossed the paper back under the desk. "No. I thought I could. Then she hired Sistrunk. I tried to speak to her in court yesterday, but they were guarding her too closely. Tried to speak to the Hubbard kids, too, but they weren't too friendly."
"You're a popular man these days, Jake."
"I didn't feel too popular yesterday. But Judge Attlee likes me.
I heard he wasn't too impressed with Systrom.
No, he wasn't. The jury won't be either.
So you're asking for a jury?
Yes, His Honor wants one, but you didn't hear it from me.
I did not. You got to figure out a way to get to her. Systrunk will piss off everybody in the state, and she won't get a dime.
Should she?
Hell yeah. It's Seth's money. If he wants to leave it to the Communist Party, then it's his business. He made it all by himself. He can damn sure give it away as he pleases. Wait till you deal with those two kids. A couple of sacks of shit, if you ask me, and you'll understand why Seth picked somebody else.
I thought you hated Seth.
I did, 10 years ago. But then I always hate the jerk on the other side. That's what makes me so mean. I get over it eventually. Hate him or love him, he wrote a will before he died, and the law has got to support that will, if in fact it's valid.
Is it valid?
That's up to the jury, and it'll be attacked from every direction.
How would you attack the will?
Harry Rex sat back and swung an ankle over a knee.
Been thinking about that. First, I'd hire me some experts, some medical guys who'll testify that Seth was drugged up with painkillers, that his body was ravaged by lung cancer, and because of all the chemo and radiation and medications that he'd been hit with over the past year, he couldn't have been thinking clearly. He was in horrible pain, and I'd hire me another expert to describe what pain can do to the thought process. Don't know where these experts are, but hell, you can hire an expert to say anything.
Keep in mind, Jake, the average juror in this county barely finished high school. Not that sophisticated. Get a slick expert or a whole team of them, and the jury can really get confused. Hell, I could make Seth Hubbard look like a slobbering idiot as he was sticking his head through that noose.
Don't you have to be crazy to hang yourself?
Can't answer that.
Second, Seth had zipper problems. Couldn't keep his pants on. Don't know if he ever crossed the color line, but maybe he did.
If a white jury sniffs even the slightest suspicion that Seth was getting something more than hot food and starched shirts from his housekeeper, then they'll be quick to turn against Miss Letty.
They can't drag up a dead man's sex life.
True. But they can nibble around the edges of Letty's. They can imply, infer, exaggerate, and use all manner of loose language. If she takes the witness stand, which she's bound to do, she becomes fair game.